Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, join us for a Radio Lillooet special presentation in 13 parts of Hendrik Willem van Loon's The Story of Mankind, the first book to win the prestigious Newbery Award in 1922.
Chapter 9 of The Story of Mankind. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. This reading by Kara Schallenberg. The Story of Mankind by Hendrik van Loon. Chapter 9. Moses. The Story of Moses, the Leader of the Jewish People. Sometime during the 20th century before our era, a small and unimportant tribe of Semitic shepherds had left its old home, which was situated in the land of Ur, on the mouth of the Euphrates, and had tried to find new pastures within the domain of the kings of Babylonia. They had been driven away by the royal soldiers, and they had moved westward, looking for a little piece of unoccupied territory where they might set up their tents. This tribe of shepherds was known as the Hebrews, or, as we call them, the Jews. They had wandered far and wide, and after many years of dreary peregrinations, they had been given shelter in Egypt. For more than 5 centuries they had dwelt among the Egyptians, and when their adopted country had been overrun by the Hyksos marauders, as I told you in the story of Egypt, they had managed to make themselves useful to the foreign invader, and had been left in the undisturbed possession of their grazing fields. But after a long war of independence, the Egyptians had driven the Hyksos out of the valley of the Nile, and then the Jews had come upon evil times, for they had been degraded to the rank of common slaves, and they had been forced to work on the royal roads and on the pyramids. And as the frontiers were guarded by the Egyptian soldiers, it had been impossible for the Jews to escape. After many years of suffering, they were saved from their miserable fate by a young Jew called Moses, who for a long time had dwelt in the desert, and there had learned to appreciate the simple virtues of his earliest ancestors, who had kept away from cities and city life, and had refused to let themselves be corrupted by the ease and the luxury of a foreign civilization. Moses decided to bring his people back to a love of the ways of the patriarchs. He succeeded in evading the Egyptian troops that were sent after him, and led his fellow tribesmen into the heart of the plain at the foot of Mount Sinai. During his long and lonely life in the desert, he had learned to revere the strength of the great God of the thunder and the storm, who ruled the high heavens, and upon whom the shepherds depended for life and light and breath. This God, one of the many divinities who were widely worshipped in Western Asia, was called Jehovah, and through the teaching of Moses he became the sole master of the Hebrew race. One day Moses disappeared from the camp of the Jews. It was whispered that he had gone away carrying 2 tablets of rough-hewn stone. That afternoon the top of the mountain was lost to sight. The darkness of a terrible storm hid it from the eye of man. But when Moses returned, behold, there stood engraved upon the tablets the words which Jehovah had spoken unto the people of Israel, amidst the crash of his thunder and the blinding flashes of his lightning. And from that moment Jehovah was recognized by all the Jews as the highest master of their fate, the only true God, who had taught them how to live holy lives when he bade them follow the wise lessons of his 10 commandments. They followed Moses when he bade them continue their journey through the desert. They obeyed him when he told them what to eat and drink, and what to avoid, that they might keep well in the hot climate. And finally, after many years of wandering, they came to a land which seemed pleasant and prosperous. It was called Palestine, which means the country of the Philistu, the Philistines, a small tribe of Cretans who had settled along the coast after they had been driven away from their own island. Unfortunately, the mainland, Palestine, was already inhabited by another Semitic race called the Canaanites. But the Jews forced their way into the valleys and built themselves cities and constructed a mighty temple in a town which they named Jerusalem, the home of peace. As for Moses, he was no longer the leader of his people. He had been allowed to see the mountain ridges of Palestine from afar, Then he had closed his tired eyes for all time. He had worked faithfully and hard to please Jehovah. Not only had he guided his brethren out of foreign slavery into the free and independent life of a new home, but he had also made the Jews the first of all nations to worship a single God. End of chapter 9, read on August 6, 2008, in San Diego, California.
The Story of Mankind by Hendrik von Loen. Chapter 10, The Phoenicians. The Phoenicians who gave us our alphabet. The Phoenicians, who were the neighbors of the Jews, were a Semitic tribe which, at a very early age, had settled along the shores of the Mediterranean. They had built themselves two well-fortified towns, Tyre and Sidon, and within a short time they had gained a monopoly of the trade of the western seas. Their ships went regularly to Greece and Italy and Spain, and they even ventured beyond the Straits of Gibraltar to visit the Scilly Islands, where they could buy tin. Wherever they went, they built themselves small trading stations, which they called colonies. Many of these were the origin of modern cities, such as Cadiz and Marseille. Here is a picture of a Phoenician trader. They bought and sold whatever promised to bring them a good profit. They were not troubled by a conscience. If we are to believe all their neighbors, they did not know what the words honesty or integrity meant. They regarded a well-filled treasure chest the highest ideal of all good citizens. Indeed, they were very unpleasant people, and did not have a single friend. Nevertheless, they have rendered all coming generations one service of the greatest possible value. They gave us our alphabet. The Phoenicians had been familiar with the art of writing, invented by the Sumerians, but they regarded these pothooks as a clumsy waste of time. They were practical businessmen, and could not spend hours engraving two or three letters. They set to work and invented a new system of writing, which was greatly superior to the old one. They borrowed a few pictures from the Egyptians, and they simplified a number of the wedge-shaped figures of the Sumerians. They sacrificed the pretty looks of the older system for the advantage of speed, and they reduced the thousands of different images to a short and handy alphabet of 22 letters. In due course of time, this alphabet traveled across the Aegean Sea and entered Greece. The Greeks added a few letters of their own and carried the improved system to Italy. The Romans modified the figures somewhat, and in turn taught them to the wild barbarians of Western Europe. Those wild barbarians were our own ancestors, and that is the reason why this book is written in characters that are of Phoenician origin, and not in the hieroglyphics of the Egyptians or in the nail script of the Sumerians. End of chapter 10. Recording by Michelle Crandall. Fremont, California, September 2008.
The Story of Mankind by Hendrik van Loen. Chapter 11. The Indo-Europeans. The Indo-European Persians conquer the Semitic and the Egyptian world. The world of Egypt and Babylon and Assyria and Phoenicia had existed almost 30 centuries, and the venerable races of the Fertile Valley were getting old and tired. Their doom was sealed when a new and more energetic race appeared upon the horizon. We call this race the Indo-European race because it conquered not only Europe, but also made itself the ruling class in the country which is now known as British India. These Indo-Europeans were white men, like the Semites, but they spoke a different language, which is regarded as the common ancestor of all European tongues, with the exception of Hungarian and Finnish and the Basque dialects of northern Spain. When we first hear of them, they had been living along the shores of the Caspian Sea for many centuries. But one day they had packed their tents, and they had wandered forth in search of a new home. Some of them had moved into the mountains of Central Asia, and for many centuries they had lived among the peaks which surround the plateau of Iran, and that is why we call them Aryans. Others had followed the setting sun, and they had taken possession of the plains of Europe, as I shall tell you, when I give you the story of Greece and Rome. For the moment we must follow the Aryans. Under the leadership of Zarathustra, or Zoroaster, who was their great teacher, many of them had left their mountain homes to follow the swiftly flowing Indus River on its way to the sea. Others had preferred to stay among the hills of Western Asia, and there they had founded the half-independent communities of the Medes and the Persians, two peoples whose names we have copied from the old Greek history books. In the 7th century before the birth of Christ, the Medes had established a kingdom of their own called Media, but this perished when Cyrus, the chief of a clan known as the Anshan, made himself king of all the Persian tribes, and started upon a career of conquest which soon made him and his children the undisputed masters of the whole of Western Asia and of Egypt. Indeed, with such energy did these Indo-European Persians push their triumphant campaigns in the West, that they soon found themselves in serious difficulties with certain other Indo-European tribes, which, centuries before, had moved into Europe, and had taken possession of the Greek peninsula and the islands of the Aegean Sea. These difficulties led to the three famous wars between Greece and Persia, during which King Darius and King Xerxes of Persia invaded the northern part of the peninsula. They ravaged the lands of the Greeks and tried very hard to get a foothold upon the European continent. But in this they did not succeed. The navy of Athens proved unconquerable. By cutting off the lines of supplies of the Persian armies, the Greek sailors invariably forced the Asiatic rulers to return to their base. It was the first encounter between Asia, the ancient teacher, and Europe, the young and eager pupil. A great many of the other chapters of this book will tell you how the struggle between East and West has continued until this very day. End of chapter 11, read by Kara Schallenberg on August 6, 2008, in San Diego, California.
The Story of Mankind by Hendrik von Lohn. Chapter 12, The Aegean Sea. The people of the Aegean Sea carried the civilization of old Asia into the wilderness of Europe. When Heinrich Schliemann was a little boy, his father told him the story of Troy. He liked that story better than anything else he had ever heard, and he made up his mind that as soon as he was big enough to leave home, he would travel to Greece and find Troy. That he was the son of a poor country parson in a Mecklenburg village did not bother him. He knew that he would need money, but he decided to gather a fortune first and do the digging afterwards. As a matter of fact, he managed to get a large fortune within a very short time, and as soon as he had enough money to equip an expedition, he went to the northwest corner of Asia Minor, where he supposed that Troy had been situated. Here you see a picture of a Trojan horse. In that particular nook of old Asia Minor stood a high mound covered with grain fields. According to tradition, it had been the home of Priamus, the king of Troy. Schliemann, whose enthusiasm was somewhat greater than his knowledge, wasted no time in preliminary explorations. At once he began to dig, and he dug with such zeal and such speed that his trench went straight through the heart of the city for which he was looking, and carried him into the ruins of another buried town, which was at least 1,000 years older than the Troy of which Homer had written. Then something very interesting occurred. If Schliemann had found a few polished stone hammers, and perhaps a few pieces of crude pottery, no one would have been surprised. Instead of discovering such objects, which people had generally associated with the prehistoric men who had lived in these regions before the coming of the Greeks, Schliemann found beautiful statuettes and very costly jewelry, and ornamented vases of a pattern that was unknown to the Greeks. He ventured the suggestion that fully 10 centuries before the great Trojan War, the coast of the Aegean had been inhabited by a mysterious race of men, who in many ways had been the superiors of the wild Greek tribes, who had invaded their country and had destroyed their civilization or absorbed it until it had lost all trace of originality. Here you see a picture of a mound that has several cities buried underneath different layers of sediment, and it's entitled Schliemann Digs for Troy. And this proved to be the case. In the late 70s of the last century, Schliemann visited the ruins of Mycenae, ruins which were so old that Roman guidebooks marveled at their antiquity. There again, beneath the flat slabs of stone of a small round enclosure, Schliemann stumbled upon a wonderful treasure trove which had been left behind by those mysterious people who had covered the Greek coast with their cities, and who had built walls so big and so heavy and so strong that the Greeks called them the works of the Titans, those godlike giants who in very olden days had used to play ball with mountain peaks. Here you see a picture of Mycenae and Argolis, a man standing underneath a wall which has a very large arch in it. A very careful study of these many relics has done away with some of the romantic features of the story. The makers of those early works of art and the builders of these strong fortresses were no sorcerers, but simple sailors and traders. They had lived in Crete and on the many small islands of the Aegean Sea. They had been hardy mariners, and they had turned the Aegean into a center of commerce for the exchange of goods between the highly civilized East and the slowly developing wilderness of the European mainland. Here you see a picture of an Aegean ship. On the Aegean Sea it's got a sail, and it's being tossed about by the waves. For more than 1,000 years, they had maintained an island empire which had developed a very high form of art. Indeed, their most important city, Cnosus, on the northern coast of Crete, had been entirely modern in its insistence upon hygiene and comfort. The palace had been properly drained, and the houses had been provided with stoves, and the Cnosians had been the first people to make a daily use of the hitherto unknown bathtub. The palace of their king had been famous for its winding staircases and its large banqueting hall. The cellars underneath this palace, where the wine and the grain and the olive oil were stored, had been so vast, and had so greatly impressed the first Greek visitors, that they had given rise to the story of the labyrinth, the name which we give to a structure with so many complicated passages that it is almost impossible to find our way out, once the front door has closed upon our frightened selves. But what finally became of this great Aegean empire, and what caused its sudden downfall, that I cannot tell. The Cretans were familiar with the art of writing, but no one has yet been able to decipher their inscriptions. Their history, therefore, is unknown to us. We have to reconstruct the record of their adventures from the ruins which the Aegeans have left behind. These ruins make it clear that the Aegean world was suddenly conquered by a less civilized race which had recently come from the plains of northern Europe. Unless we are very much mistaken, the savages who were responsible for the destruction of the Cretan and the Aegean civilization were none other than certain tribes of wandering shepherds who had just taken possession of the rocky peninsula between the Adriatic and the Aegean seas, and who are known to us as Greeks. Here you see a large map that depicts the island ridges between Asia and Europe, which are a series of islands that connect Asia and its environs to different places in Europe. End of chapter 12. Recorded by Michelle Crandall, Fremont, California, November 2008.
The Story of Mankind by Hendrik van Loon, Chapter 13, The Greeks. Meanwhile, the Indo-European tribe of the Hellenes was taking possession of Greece. The pyramids were 1,000 years old, and were beginning to show the first signs of decay, and Hammurabi, the wise king of Babylon, had been dead and buried several centuries, when a small tribe of shepherds left their homes along the banks of the river Danube and wandered southward in search of fresh pastures. They called themselves Hellenes, after Helen, the son of Deucalion and Pyrrha. According to the old myths, these were the only two human beings who had escaped the great flood, which countless years before had destroyed all the people of the world, when they had grown so wicked that they disgusted Zeus, the mighty god, who lived on Mount Olympus. Of these early Hellenes we know nothing. Thucydides, the historian of the fall of Athens, describing his earliest ancestors, said that they did not amount to very much, and this was probably true. They were very ill-mannered. They lived like pigs and threw the bodies of their enemies to the wild dogs who guarded their sheep. They had very little respect for other people's rights, and they killed the natives of the Greek peninsula, who were called the Pelasgians, and stole their farms and took their cattle and made their wives and daughters slaves, and wrote endless songs praising the courage of the clan of the Achaeans, who had led the Hellenic advance guard into the mountains of Thessaly and the Peloponnesus. But here and there, on the tops of high rocks, they saw the castles of the Achaeans, and those they did not attack, for they feared the metal swords and the spears of the Achaean soldiers, and knew that they could not hope to defeat them with their clumsy stone axes. For many centuries they continued to wander from valley to valley, and from mountainside to mountainside. Then the whole of the land had been occupied, and the migration had come to an end. That moment was the beginning of Greek civilization. The Greek farmer, living within sight of the Achaean colonies, was finally driven by curiosity to visit his haughty neighbors. He discovered that he could learn many useful things from the men who dwelt behind the high stone walls of Mycenae and Tiryns. He was a clever pupil. Within a short time he mastered the art of handling those strange iron weapons which the Achaeans had brought from Babylon and from Thebes. He came to understand the mysteries of navigation. He began to build little boats for his own use. And when he had learned everything the Achaeans could teach him, he turned upon his teachers and drove them back to their islands. Soon afterwards he ventured forth upon the sea and conquered all the cities of the Aegean. Finally, in the 15th century before our era, he plundered and ravaged Knossos, and 10 centuries after their first appearance upon the scene, the Hellenes were the undisputed rulers of Greece, of the Aegean, and of the coastal regions of Asia Minor. Troy, the last great commercial stronghold of the older civilization, was destroyed in the 11th century BC. European history was to begin in all seriousness. End of chapter 13. Recorded on Monday, August 25th, 2008, in San Diego, California.
The Story of Mankind by Hendrik von Lohn. Chapter 14. The Greek Cities. The Greek cities that were released states. We modern people love the sound of the word big. We pride ourselves upon the fact that we belong to the biggest country in the world, and possess the biggest navy and grow the biggest oranges and potatoes, and we love to live in cities of millions of inhabitants, and when we are dead we are buried in the biggest cemetery of the whole state. A citizen of ancient Greece, could he have heard us talk, would not have known what we meant. Moderation in all things was the ideal of his life, and mere bulk did not impress him at all. And this love of moderation was not merely a hollow phrase used upon special occasions. It influenced the life of the Greeks from the day of their birth to the hour of their death. It was part of their literature, and it made them build small but perfect temples. It found expression in the clothes which the men wore, and in the rings and the bracelets of their wives. It followed the crowds that went to the theater, and made them hoot down any playwright who dared to sin against the iron law of good taste or good sense. Here you see a picture of Mount Olympus where the gods lived. It is a two-peaked mountain with a bowl in the middle. The Greeks even insisted upon this quality in their politicians, and in their most popular athletes. When a powerful runner came to Sparta, and boasted that he could stand longer on one foot than any other man in Hellas, the people drove him from the city because he prided himself upon an accomplishment at which he could be beaten by any common goose. That is all very well, you will say, and no doubt it is a great virtue to care so much for moderation and perfection, but why should the Greeks have been the only people to develop this quality in olden times? For an answer, I shall point to the way in which the Greeks lived. The people of Egypt or Mesopotamia had been the subjects of a mysterious supreme ruler who lived miles and miles away in a dark palace, and who was rarely seen by the masses of the population. The Greeks, on the other hand, were free citizens of 100 independent little cities, the largest of which counted fewer inhabitants than a large modern village. When a peasant, who lived in Ur, said that he was a Babylonian, he meant that he was one of millions of other people who paid tribute to the king, who at that particular moment happened to be a master of Western Asia. But when a Greek said proudly that he was an Athenian or a Theban, he spoke of a small town, which was both his home and his country, and which recognized no master but the will of the people in the marketplace. To the Greek, his fatherland was the place where he was born, where he had spent his earliest years playing hide-and-seek amidst the forbidden rocks of the Acropolis, where he had grown into manhood with a thousand other boys and girls whose nicknames were as familiar to him as those of your own schoolmates. His fatherland was the holy soil where his father and mother lay buried. It was the small house within the high city walls where his wife and children lived in safety. It was a complete world which covered no more than 4 or 5 acres of rocky land. Don't you see how these surroundings must have influenced a man in everything he did and said and thought? The people of Babylon and Assyria and Egypt had been part of a vast mob. They had been lost in the multitude. The Greek, on the other hand, had never lost touch with his immediate surroundings. He never ceased to be a part of the little town where everybody knew everyone else. He felt that his intelligent neighbors were watching him. Whatever he did, whether he wrote plays or made statues out of marble or composed songs, he remembered that his efforts were going to be judged by all the freeborn citizens of his hometown who knew about such things. This knowledge forced him to strive after perfection, and perfection, as he had been taught from childhood, was not possible without moderation. In this hard school, the Greeks learned to excel in many things. They created new forms of government, and new forms of literature, and new ideals in art which we have never been able to surpass. They performed these miracles in little villages that covered less ground than 4 or 5 modern city blocks. And look what finally happened. In the 4th century before our era, Alexander of Macedonia conquered the world. As soon as he had done with fighting, Alexander decided that he must bestow the benefits of the true Greek genius upon all mankind. He took it away from the little cities and the little villages, and tried to make it blossom and bear fruit amidst the vast royal residences of his newly acquired empire. But the Greeks, removed from the familiar sight of their own temples, removed from the well-known sounds and smells of their own crooked streets, at once lost the cheerful joy and the marvelous sense of moderation which had inspired the work of their hands and brains while they labored for the glory of their old city-states. They became cheap artisans, content with second-rate work. The day the little city-states of old Hellas lost their independence and were forced to become part of a big nation, the old Greek spirit died, and it has been dead ever since. End of chapter 14, recorded by Michelle Crandall, Fremont, California, November 2008.
The Story of Mankind by Hendrik van Loon. Chapter 15. Greek Self-Government. The Greeks were the first people to try the difficult experiment of self-government. In the beginning, all the Greeks had been equally rich and equally poor. Every man had owned a certain number of cows and sheep. His mud hut had been his castle. He had been free to come and go as he wished. Whenever it was necessary to discuss matters of public importance, all the citizens had gathered in the marketplace. One of the older men of the village was elected chairman, and it was his duty to see that everybody had a chance to express his views. In case of war, a particularly energetic and self-confident villager was chosen commander-in-chief, but the same people who had voluntarily given this man the right to be their leader claimed an equal right to deprive him of his job once the danger had been averted. But gradually the village had grown into a city. Some people had worked hard and others had been lazy, a few had been unlucky, and still others had been just plain dishonest in dealing with their neighbors and had gathered wealth. As a result, the city no longer consisted of a number of men who were equally well off. On the contrary, it was inhabited by a small class of very rich people and a large class of very poor ones. There had been another change. The old commander-in-chief, who had been willingly recognized as headman or king because he knew how to lead his men to victory, had disappeared from the scene. His place had been taken by the nobles, a class of rich people who, during the course of time, had got hold of an undue share of the farms and estates. These nobles enjoyed many advantages over the common crowd of freemen. They were able to buy the best weapons which were to be found on the market of the eastern Mediterranean. They had much spare time in which they could practice the art of fighting. They lived in strongly built houses, and they could hire soldiers to fight for them. They were constantly quarrelling among each other to decide who should rule the city. The victorious nobleman then assumed a sort of kingship over all his neighbours, and governed the town until he in turn was killed or driven away by still another ambitious nobleman. Such a king, by the grace of his soldiers, was called a tyrant, and during the 7th and 6th centuries before our era, every Greek city was for a time ruled by such tyrants, many of whom, by the way, happened to be exceedingly capable men. But in the long run, this state of affairs became unbearable. Then attempts were made to bring about reforms, and out of these reforms grew the first democratic government of which the world has a record. It was early in the 7th century that the people of Athens decided to do some housecleaning and give the large number of freemen once more a voice in the government as they were supposed to have had in the days of their Achaean ancestors. They asked a man by the name of Draco to provide them with a set of laws that would protect the poor against the aggressions of the rich. Draco set to work. Unfortunately, he was a professional lawyer and very much out of touch with ordinary life. In his eyes, a crime was a crime, and when he had finished his code, the people of Athens discovered that these draconian laws were so severe that they could not possibly be put into effect. There would not have been rope enough to hang all the criminals under their new system of jurisprudence, which made the stealing of an apple a capital offense. The Athenians looked about for a more humane reformer. At last they found someone who could do that sort of thing better than anybody else. His name was Solon. He belonged to a noble family, and he had travelled all over the world and had studied the forms of government of many other countries. After a careful study of the subject, Solon gave Athens a set of laws which bore testimony to that wonderful principle of moderation which was part of the Greek character. He tried to improve the condition of the peasant, without, however, destroying the prosperity of the nobles who were, or rather who could be, of such great service to the state as soldiers. To protect the poorer classes against abuse on the part of the judges, who were always elected from the class of the nobles because they received no salary, Solon made a provision whereby a citizen with a grievance had the right to state his case before a jury of 30 of his fellow Athenians. Most important of all, Solon forced the average freeman to take a direct and personal interest in the affairs of the city. No longer could he stay at home and say, "Oh, I am too busy today," or "It is raining and I had better stay indoors." He was expected to do his share, to be at the meeting of the town council, and carry part of the responsibility for the safety and the prosperity of the state. This government by the demos, the people, was often far from successful. There was too much idle talk. There were too many hateful and spiteful scenes between rivals for official honor. But it taught the Greek people to be independent, and to rely upon themselves for their salvation, and that was a very good thing. End of chapter 15, read on August 25th, 2008 in San Diego, California.
The Story of Mankind by Hendrik von Lohn. Chapter 16, Greek Life. How the Greeks Lived. But how, you will ask, did the ancient Greeks have time to look after their families and their business if they were forever running to the marketplace to discuss affairs of state? In this chapter I shall tell you. In all matters of government, the Greek democracy recognized only one class of citizens, the freemen. Every Greek city was composed of a number of freeborn citizens, a large number of slaves, and a sprinkling of foreigners. At rare intervals, usually during a war, when men were needed for the army, the Greeks showed themselves willing to confer the rights of citizenship upon the barbarians, as they called the foreigners. But this was an exception. Citizenship was a matter of birth. You were an Athenian because your father and your grandfather had been Athenians before you. But, however great your merits as a trader or a soldier, if you were born of non-Athenian parents, you remained a foreigner until the end of time. The Greek city, therefore, whenever it was not ruled by a king or a tyrant, was run by and for the freemen, and this would not have been possible without a large army of slaves who outnumbered the free citizens at the rate of 6 or 5 to 1, and who performed those tasks to which we modern people must devote most of our time and energy if we wish to provide for our families and pay the rent of our apartments. The slaves did all the cooking and baking and candlestick making of the entire city. They were the tailors and the carpenters and the jewelers and the school teachers and the bookkeepers, and they tended the store and looked after the factory, while the master went to the public meeting to discuss questions of war and peace, or visited the theater to see the latest play of Aeschylus, or hear a discussion of the revolutionary ideas of Euripides, who had dared to express certain doubts upon the omnipotence of the great god Zeus. Here you see a picture of a temple upon a hill, with all the freemen indicated as being inside and discussing, and then all of the slaves down around working at the foot of the hill in the marketplace and elsewhere. And it's titled Greek Society. Indeed, ancient Athens resembled a modern club. All the freeborn citizens were hereditary members, and all the slaves were hereditary servants, and waited upon the needs of their masters, and it was very pleasant to be a member of the organization. But when we talk about slaves, we do not mean the sort of people about whom you have read in the pages of Uncle Tom's Cabin. It is true that the position of those slaves who tilled the fields was a very unpleasant one, but the average freeman who had come down in the world, and who had been obliged to hire himself out as a farmhand, led just as miserable a life. In the cities, furthermore, many of the slaves were more prosperous than the poorer classes of the freemen. For the Greeks, who loved moderation in all things, did not like to treat their slaves after the fashion which afterward was so common in Rome, where a slave had as few rights as an engine in a modern factory, and could be thrown to the wild animals upon the smallest pretext. The Greeks accepted slavery as a necessary institution, without which no city could possibly become the home of a truly civilized people. The slaves also took care of those tasks which nowadays are performed by the businessmen and the professional men. As for those household duties which take up so much of the time of your mother, and which worry your father when he comes home from his office, the Greeks, who understood the value of leisure, had reduced such duties to the smallest possible minimum by living amidst surroundings of extreme simplicity. To begin with, their homes were very plain. Even the rich nobles spent their lives in a sort of adobe barn, which lacked all the comforts which a modern workman expects as his natural right. A Greek home consisted of four walls and a roof. There was a door which led into the street, but there were no windows. The kitchen, the living rooms, and the sleeping quarters were built around an open courtyard, in which there was a small fountain, or a statue and a few plants to make it look bright. Within this courtyard, the family lived when it did not rain or when it was not too cold. In one corner of the yard, the cook, who was a slave, prepared the meal, and in another corner the teacher, who was also a slave, taught the children and the Alpha Beta Gamma, and the tables of multiplication, and in still another corner the lady of the house, who rarely left her domain, since it was not considered good form for a married woman to be seen on the street too often, was repairing her husband's coat with her seamstresses, who were slaves. And in the little office, right off the door, the master was inspecting the accounts which the overseer of his farm, who was a slave, had just brought to him. When dinner was ready, the family came together, but the meal was a very simple one and did not take much time. The Greeks seem to have regarded eating as an unavoidable evil and not a pastime, which kills many dreary hours and eventually kills many dreary people. They lived on bread and on wine, with a little meat and some green vegetables. They drank water only when nothing else was available, because they did not think it very healthy. They loved to call on each other for dinner, but our idea of a festive meal where everybody is supposed to eat much more than is good for him would have disgusted them. They came together at the table for the purpose of a good talk and a good glass of wine and water, but as they were moderate people, they despised those who drank too much. Here you see a picture of a temple on a hill with a small lake at the foot of the hill and a road winding up the side to the temple. The same simplicity which prevailed in the dining room also dominated their choice of clothes. They liked to be clean and well-groomed, to have their hair and beards neatly cut, to feel their bodies strong with the exercise and the swimming of the gymnasium, but they never followed the Asiatic fashion which prescribed loud colors and strange patterns. They wore a long white coat and they managed to look as smart as a modern Italian officer in his long blue cape. They loved to see their wives wear ornaments, but they thought it very vulgar to display their wealth, or their wives, in public, and whenever the women left their home they were as inconspicuous as possible. In short, the story of Greek life is a story not only of moderation, but also of simplicity. Things, chairs and tables and books and houses and carriages, are apt to take up a great deal of their owner's time. In the end, they invariably make him their slave, and his hours are spent looking after their wants, keeping them polished and brushed and painted. The Greeks, before everything else, wanted to be free, both in mind and in body. That they might maintain their liberty and be truly free in spirit, they reduced their daily needs to the lowest possible point. End of chapter 16. Recorded by Michelle Crandall, Fremont, California, November 2008.
The Story of Mankind by Hendrik von Loon. Chapter 17. The Greek Theatre. The Origins of the Theatre, the First Form of Public Amusement. At a very early stage of their history, the Greeks had begun to collect the poems which had been written in honor of their brave ancestors, who had driven the Pelasgians out of Hellas and had destroyed the power of Troy. These poems were recited in public, and everybody came to listen to them. But the theatre, the form of entertainment which has become almost a necessary part of our own lives, did not grow out of these recited heroic tales. It had such a curious origin that I must tell you something about it in a separate chapter. The Greeks had always been fond of parades. Every year they held solemn processions in honor of Dionysus, the god of the wine. As everybody in Greece drank wine, the Greeks thought water only useful for the purpose of swimming and sailing. This particular divinity was as popular as a god of the soda fountain would be in our own land. And because the wine god was supposed to live in the vineyards, amidst a merry mob of satyrs, strange creatures who were half man and half goat, the crowd that joined the procession used to wear goat skins and to hee-haw like real billy goats. The Greek word for goat is tragos, and the Greek word for singer is oidos. The singer who meh-med like a goat, therefore, was called a tragos oidos, or goat singer, and it is this strange name which developed into the modern word tragedy, which means, in the theatrical sense, a piece with an unhappy ending, just as comedy, which really means the singing of something komos, or gay, is the name given to a play which ends happily. But how, you will ask, did this noisy chorus of masqueraders, stamping around like wild goats, ever develop into the noble tragedies which have filled the theatres of the world for almost 2,000 years. The connecting link between the goat singer and Hamlet is really very simple, as I shall show you in a moment. The singing chorus was very amusing in the beginning, and attracted large crowds of spectators, who stood along the side of the road and laughed. But soon this business of hee-hawing grew tiresome, and the Greeks thought dullness an evil only comparable to ugliness or sickness. They asked for something more entertaining. Then an inventive young poet from the village of Icaria in Attica hit upon a new idea which proved a tremendous success. He made one of the members of the goat chorus step forward and engage in conversation with the leader of the musicians, who marched at the head of the parade playing upon their pipes of Pan. This individual was allowed to step out of line. He waved his arms and gesticulated while he spoke, that is to say, he acted, while the others merely stood by and sang. And he asked a lot of questions, which the bandmaster answered according to the roll of papyrus, upon which the poet had written down these answers before the show began. This rough and ready conversation, the dialogue, which told the story of Dionysus or one of the other gods, became at once popular with the crowd. Henceforth every Dionysian procession had an acted scene, and very soon the acting was considered more important than the procession and the meh-meh-ing. Aeschylus, the most successful of all tragedians, who wrote no less than 80 plays during his long life, from 526 to 455 BC, made a bold step forward when he introduced two actors instead of one. A generation later, Sophocles increased the number of actors to 3. When Euripides began to write his terrible tragedies in the middle of the 5th century BC, he was allowed as many actors as he liked, and when Aristophanes wrote those famous comedies in which he poked fun at everybody and everything, including the gods of Mount Olympus, the chorus had been reduced to the role of mere bystanders, who were lined up behind the principal performers, and who sang, "This is a terrible world," while the hero in the foreground committed a crime against the will of the gods. This new form of dramatic entertainment demanded a proper setting, and soon every Greek city owned a theater, cut out of the rock of a nearby hill. The spectators sat upon wooden benches and faced a wide circle, our present orchestra, where you pay $3.30 for a seat. Upon this half-circle, which was the stage, the actors and the chorus took their stand. Behind them there was a tent, where they made up with large clay masks, which hid their faces and which showed the spectators whether the actors were supposed to be happy and smiling, or unhappy and weeping. The Greek word for tent is skene, and that is the reason why we talk of the scenery of the stage. When once the tragedy had become part of Greek life, the people took it very seriously, and never went to the theater to give their minds a vacation. A new play became as important an event as an election, and a successful playwright was received with greater honors than those bestowed upon a general who had just returned from a famous victory. End of chapter 17. Read on October 10th, 2008, in San Diego, California.
The Story of Mankind by Hendrik Von Loan. Chapter 18. The Persian Wars. How the Greeks defended Europe against Asiatic invasion and drove the Persians back across the Aegean Sea. The Greeks had learned the art of trading from the Aegeans, who had been the pupils of the Phoenicians. They had founded colonies after the Phoenician pattern. They had even improved upon the Phoenician methods by a more general use of money in dealing with foreign customers. In the 6th century before our era, they had established themselves firmly along the coast of Asia Minor, and they were taking away trade from the Phoenicians at a fast rate. This the Phoenicians, of course, did not like, but they were not strong enough to risk a war with their Greek competitors. They sat and waited, nor did they wait in vain. In a former chapter, I have told you how a humble tribe of Persian shepherds had suddenly gone upon the warpath and had conquered the greater part of Western Asia. The Persians were too civilized to plunder their new subjects. They contented themselves with a yearly tribute. When they reached the coast of Asia Minor, they insisted that the Greek colonies of Lydia recognize the Persian kings as their overlords and pay them a stipulated tax. The Greek colonies objected. The Persians insisted. Then the Greek colonies appealed to the home country, and the stage was set for a quarrel. For if the truth be told, the Persian kings regarded the Greek city-states as very dangerous political institutions and bad examples for all other people who were supposed to be the patient slaves of the mighty Persian kings. Of course, the Greeks enjoyed a certain degree of safety because their country lay hidden beyond the deep waters of the Aegean. But here their old enemies, the Phoenicians, stepped forward with offers of help and advice to the Persians. If the Persian king would provide the soldiers, the Phoenicians would guarantee to deliver the necessary ships to carry them to Europe. It was the year 492 before the birth of Christ, and Asia made ready to destroy the rising power of Europe. As a final warning, the king of Persia sent messengers to the Greeks asking for earth and water as a token of their submission. The Greeks promptly threw the messengers into the nearest well, where they would find both earth and water in large abundance, and thereafter, of course, peace was impossible. But the gods of high Olympus watched over their children, and when the Phoenician fleet carrying the Persian troops was near Mount Athos, the storm god blew his cheeks until he almost burst the veins of his brow, and the fleet was destroyed by a terrible hurricane, and the Persians were all drowned. Here you see a picture of the Persian fleet as it is destroyed near Mount Athos. 2 years later, more Persians came. This time they sailed straight across the Aegean Sea and landed near the village of Marathon. As soon as the Athenians heard this, they sent their army of 10,000 men to guard the hills that surrounded the Marathonian plain. At the same time, they dispatched a fast runner to Sparta to ask for help, But Sparta was envious of the fame of Athens, and refused to come to her assistance. The other Greek cities followed her example, with the exception of tiny Plataea, which sent 1,000 men. On the 12th of September of the year 490, Multiades, the Athenian commander, threw this little army against the hordes of the Persians. The Greeks broke through the Persian barrage of arrows, and their spears caused terrible havoc among the disorganized Asiatic troops, who had never been called upon to resist such an enemy. That night the people of Athens watched the sky grow red with the flame of burning ships. Anxiously they waited for news. At last a little cloud of dust appeared upon the road that led to the north. It was Pheidippides, the runner. He stumbled and gasped, for his end was near. Only a few days before had he returned from his errand to Sparta. He had hastened to join Miltiades. That morning he had taken part in the attack, and later he had volunteered to carry the news of victory to his beloved city. The people saw him fall, and they rushed forward to support him. "We have won," he whispered, and then he died, a glorious death, which made him envied of all men. Here you see a picture of a map that describes the movements of the Greeks and the Persians in the Battle of Marathon. As for the Persians, they tried, after this defeat, to land near Athens, but they found the coast guarded and disappeared, and once more the land of Hellas was at peace. 8 years they waited, and during this time the Greeks were not idle. They knew that a final attack was to be expected, but they did not agree upon the best way to avert the danger. Some people wanted to increase the army. Others said that a strong fleet was necessary for success. The two parties, led by Aristides, for the army, and Themistocles, the leader of the bigger navy men, fought each other bitterly, and nothing was done until Aristides was exiled. Then Themistocles had his chance, and he built all the ships he could, and turned the Piraeus into a strong naval base. In the year 481 BC, a tremendous Persian army appeared in Thessaly, a province of northern Greece. In this hour of danger, Sparta, the great military city of Greece, was elected commander-in-chief. But the Spartans cared little what happened to northern Greece, provided their own country was not invaded. They neglected to fortify the passes that led into Greece. A small detachment of Spartans, under Leonidas, had been told to guard the narrow road between the high mountains and the sea, which connected Thessaly with the southern provinces. Leonidas obeyed his orders. He fought and held the pass with unequaled bravery. But a traitor by the name of Ephialtes, who knew the little byways of Malis, guided a regiment of Persians through the hills, and made it possible for them to attack Leonidas in the rear. Near the warm wells, the Thermopylae, a terrible battle was fought. Here you see a picture of Thermopylae. When night came, Leonidas and his faithful soldiers lay dead under the corpses of their enemies. Here you see another picture of the Battle of Thermopylae, which is a map showing where the main Persian army marched to Athens. But the pass had been lost, and the greater part of Greece fell into the hands of the Persians. They marched upon Athens, threw the garrison from the rocks of the Acropolis, and burned the city. The people fled to the island of Salamis. All seemed lost. But on the 20th of September of the year 480, Themistocles forced the Persian fleet to give battle within the narrow straits which separated the island of Salamis from the mainland, and within a few hours he destroyed three-quarters of the Persian ships. Here you see a picture of the Persians burning Athens and the ships in the harbor. In this way, the victory of Thermopylae came to naught. Xerxes was forced to retire. The next year, so he decreed, would bring a final decision. He took his troops to Thessaly, and there he waited for spring. But this time the Spartans understood the seriousness of the hour. They left the safe shelter of the wall which they had built across the isthmus of Corinth, and under the leadership of Pausanias, they marched against Mardonius, the Persian general. The united Greeks, some 100,000 men from a dozen different cities, attacked the 300,000 men of the enemy near Plataea. Once more the heavy Greek infantry broke through the Persian barrage of arrows. The Persians were defeated, as they had been at Marathon, and this time they left for good. By a strange coincidence, the same day that the Greek armies won their victory near Plataea, the Athenian ships destroyed the enemy's fleet near Cape Michael in Asia Minor. Thus did the first encounter between Asia and Europe end. Athens had covered herself with glory, and Sparta had fought bravely and well. If these two cities had been able to come to an agreement, if they had been willing to forget their little jealousies, they might have become the leaders of a strong and united Hellas. But, alas, they allowed the hour of victory and enthusiasm to slip by, and the same opportunity never returned. End of Chapter 18, recorded by Michelle Crandall, Fremont, California, November 2008.
Tune in next week for another installment of this Radio Lillooet special presentation of The Story of Mankind.